got a spring or an itch.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
We talked about, or at least started the discussion concerning our memories, as well as ending the show on new advances in diabetes. And we said that we continue this week on those same topics. Well, it appears that a lot of our listeners were especially interested in our memory discussion, but even more curious on our take on improving their memory.
Last week, Dr. Lasky and I talked about the PEG method of memorizing lists. We also talked about another memory aid called the Memory Palace. I learned this along with Dr. Lasky years ago as the link method of memorization.
There have been many books written on the subject of memory and how to memorize both short and long lists. So I thought that we'd expound first on the one that I learned years ago and still use today.
Before we do that, why don't we first look at the factors that can influence how long information actually stays in our long-term memory? The way the memory is encoded in the first place can play a significant role. If you were very aware and alert when you had the experience, then the memory will probably be a lot more vivid.
Keep that word vivid in mind. We'll get back to that when we start looking at our memory PEG system. The number of times you access a memory can also play a role in the strength and duration of a memory. Now, not surprisingly, memories that you have to recall often tend to stick around more and become stronger. This is why repeating information over and over while you are studying leads to better recall on an examination.
It may appear from what we have talked about previously that there are only short, mid, and long-term memories, but we can actually divide the long-term memories into several types.
We can call them explicit and implicit. First, we have explicit memories. Now, these are the memories that are available during consciousness. And these explicit memories can be further divided into two: episodic memory, dealing with specific events, and semantic memory, which involves knowledge about the world around us.
On the other hand, implicit memories are those that are mostly unconscious. Here, we have the memories that involve body movement and how to use objects in the environment.
For example, our day-to-day memories that let us drive our car or use a computer are examples of implicit memories. Often, we think of our memories being similar to computer drives. Here, information enters short-term memory, which is a temporary storage, and which is later transferred into long-term memory, which you could say is a relatively permanent storage form. Again, kind of like saving the information in a hard disk drive.
So, when we need information in that long-term memory, we can use environmental cues to bring it into focus, just like accessing a safe folder on your computer.
So what happens when you bring forth a memory into consciousness?
Recent research suggests that memories are not saved in a static state and then pull up with perfect clarity.
Instead, as the information processing model seems to suggest, memories are transformed every single time they are assessed. Neurons first encode memories in the cortex and hippocampus of the brain. Each time a memory is recalled, it is then recoded by a similar but not identical set of neurons. Accessing memories often helps make them stronger, but it can also change these memories into something different, and we may not recognize the difference.
Later, when we bring up that memory, we may perceive it differently and not realize that the memory has actually changed. It may seem just as real and true as initial memory did.
Memory expert Elizabeth Loftus, in one of her famous experiments, demonstrated how easily false memories can be triggered. She was able to get 25% of her participants to believe in a false memory that they had once been lost in a shopping mall as a child.
One of the reasons that this happens is that our long-term memory is very susceptible to inaccuracies. In some cases, people miss important details about events.
So subconsciously, our brains fill in these missing gaps in information, occasionally fabricating details that seem to make sense. This is not done on purpose. It may just be the way that our brains try to rationalize our thoughts. You could say, bringing them into perspective.
Not only that, old memories can interfere with the formation of new ones, making it difficult to recall what actually happened.
Before, we alluded to long-term memories. While it's easy to think of memories as something similar to files in a computer, as we said before, research has shown that although long-term memory may be enduring, it is susceptible to error. A while back, I watched a documentary testing just this type of problem, but with short-term memory. A group of researchers rigged a fake accident scene in a small area of a town. Several people saw the accident, believing it to be real. On the far right of the scene was a small street leading to the main parking area. There was a prominent stop sign at the corner.
A car driven by one of the actors actually stopped at the stop sign and proceeded on. The car then ran into the side of another parked car that already had a damaged driver's side door panel.
The moving car hit directly into the area of the damage on the parked car. Within seconds, a police car came into the area, and the policemen were part of the research team, and they began questioning the witnesses to the accident. Several of those witnesses said that the car did not stop at the stop sign. Others said that there was no stop sign at the corner. And some of the witnesses said that the car that was hit was not damaged prior to the accident. The truth is that memory mistakes are really quite common.
As you and I and the researchers could see, memory is very prone to fallacy. People can feel completely confident that their memory is accurate, but this confidence is no guarantee that a particular memory is correct.
Have you ever incorrectly recalled that you locked the front door or forgot turning off the sink faucet? We've mentioned false memories, but really have to define the term if we're actually going to talk more about them. False memories are mental experiences that people believe are accurate representations of past events.
And false memories often revolve around trivial details, such as believing you put your keys on the table when you got home, or even believing you saw someone at the scene of a crime.
False memories are more than a simple mistake. They actually involve a level of certainty in the validity of that memory. We all experience memory failures from time to time, but false memories are unique in that they represent a distinct recollection of something that did not actually happen. It is not simply forgetting. It's about remembering things that we never experienced in the first place.
So, you may ask, why do false memories happen? Certainly, there can be misinformation of the event or occurrence in the first place.
But also, existing knowledge and other memories can interfere with the formation of a new memory, and this can cause the recollection of an event to be mistaken or just entirely false. Suggestion can often lead to false memories.
Researchers have shown that it is possible to induce false memories through suggestion. And the more time passes and the more vivid the memory becomes, these false memories can become stronger and more vivid as time goes on.
Over time, memories also become distorted and they begin to change. In some cases, the original memory may be changed in order to incorporate new information or experiences. People, in fact, are remarkably susceptible to suggestion, which can create memories of events and things that didn't really happen to us.
You may, for example, really remember having hung your keys up on the hook near your door that you use every day for that purpose, when in reality, you left them out in the car.
False memories are one of the leading causes of false convictions, usually through the false identification of a suspect or false recollections during police interrogations. In another study, participants watched video of an automobile accident and were then asked some questions about what they saw in the film.
Some participants were asked how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, while others were asked how fast were the cars going when they hit each other.
Basically, the only difference was the phrase smashed into each other that was substituted with hit each other. When the participants were given a memory test pertaining to the accident a week later, those who had been asked the smashed into question were more likely to have a false memory of seeing broken glass in the film. So the way that the question is worded can affect the memory and how it is remembered. And time. Time can influence false memory formation.
Now, without further ado, we will attempt to give you our PEG system that can help you to memorize lists of objects, even in a specific order, such as when you go to the supermarket with a list of needed items.
First, we need a list of words or objects that you'll forever relate to the first 10 or 12 numbers. That is, from 0 through 10 or 12. Let's start with 0. Remember that this is our list. You may find other words or objects that you remember better. Anyway, my number 0 looks to me like a hole or an open mouth. Next is the number 1. I think of it as a pencil. That's what it looks like to me. Goalposts represent the number 2, and a three-legged stool represents the number 3. Carmen gave me a chair to link the number 4 to items in the list. She says that it has 4 legs and, upside down, looks like the number 4. 5 was a hard one for me, but I use a fish hook.
A flag represents the number 6, since the number conjures up the name of an amusement park to me, which is Six Flags.
The number 7 is a pair of dice. I guess I get that from the gambling game of craps. That may be a weak connection to 7, but it works for me. The number 8 looks, well, like a pretzel, or maybe on its side the symbol of infinity.
Remember that you do not need just one symbol to represent the individual numbers. You just can't use a symbol to represent multiple numbers.
Now, where were we? Ah, yes, the number 9. My favorite billiards or pool game is called 9-ball. So I picture a pool table to represent the number 9. A set of bowling pins? Well, that consists of 10 pins and represents the number 10. Now, 0 through 10 may not be enough for you. If you want to add the number 11 and 12, you can add a football team picture to represent the number 11, as there are usually 11 men on a football team playing at one time.
And a dozen eggs in an egg create to link to the number 12. A scary picture could be linked to Friday the 13th. After all, there were several Friday the 13th movies, weren't there?
Again, make up your own associations. Maybe goalposts could represent the number 11 and a 2 be represented by a pair of eyes or a pair of anything. Numbers can also be represented by letters. We won't get into that since you can make up your own, but I use the letters I and L to represent the number 1, the letter O for 0, the letter N for 2 since it has 2 upstrokes, and M for 3, and so on. Once you've studied that for a while and memorized them, you can use these numbers to link the actual items in your list that needs to be memorized.
We went over that on the last show, but as another example, think of a shopping list of 5 items to save time. The list will consist of bananas, ground beef, apples, Wheaties cereal, and milk.
The first on the list is bananas. I'd see a banana being stabbed by 1,000 pencils. Then I picture a football player kicking a hamburger over the goalpost while running over a field of sloppy joes made of ground beef. Now we have the number 3, which could either be the three-legged stool or even a picture of a McDonald's sign on its side. We would connect that with the next item on the list, the apples. Picture a Big Mac with apple slices instead of hamburgers between the buns.
Remembering Wheaties linked to the number 4 might show you sitting on the floor in front of a huge chair that you are climbing in order to eat your breakfast of Wheaties.
Of course, this could in itself link to the next item in the list being milk. Or you could link the next number 5 with the fish hook in the milk trying to fish out the Wheaties from the bowl. The better, the more vivid, the more crazy is the association, the more easily you will remember the list.
People have literally used this PEG system to remember thousands of items in a list and been able to remember the list both backwards and forwards. It is a system that has been used successfully for years and years.
You could even do it without the number links. Just use the items to link each one to the one before. Again, using the list of bananas, ground beef, apples, Wheaties, and milk, you could start with the bananas and picture the bananas being cooked with the ground beef on a big fire. Then apples, tons of apples, are added to the mix. This is then thrown into the bowl of Wheaties filled with gallons and gallons of whole milk.
We use this sequence of numbers in the PEC system that we first described, but that could also be called a link system since we link a nonce with a non-sequential list.
But that list does not even have to be my numbers. It could be items in a familiar surrounding, such as what has been called the memory palace. We talked about that in last week's show. We have lived in our home, for example, for years and years, and I'm very familiar with the layout of most all of the items in my home, and I can picture them in order as I walk around the house. You can use that to link the items in the list, rather than the numbers 1 through 10 or 12 or wherever.
The list words don't even have to look like the numbers. They could just rhyme with the numbers such as 1 bone, 2 chew, 3 tree, 4 door, 5 hive, 6 sticks, 7 heaven, 8 plate, 9 wine, and 10 hen.
Well, it's time for our mid-show break. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky with Carmen Lasky, and this is Hey Doc. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just 2 blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School Substance Treatment Program. If you would like to make an appointment, please call us at 641-4411. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. So before we forget what we learned at the beginning of the show about memory, you could use the newfound knowledge to remember what Cara and I said in the final part of today's show, which is coming up. And here we're going to talk quickly about the difference between CBD and THC.
11 states and the District of Columbia will have a legalized recreational adult use by 2020. But as cannabis makes its way into the mainstream, it is important to know the difference between THC and CBD.
So let's talk about the ABC of CBD and THC. First of all, the cannabis plant produces a variety of chemical compounds that are called cannabinoids. While there are more than 100 cannabinoids that have been identified, the two most well-known ones are tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, and cannabidiol, or CBD.
The primary psychoactive component of cannabis is THC. In other words, it's the stuff that gets you high.
CBD, on the other hand, doesn't get you high, but it can have other effects on your body. Both act on what is called the endocannabinoid system in our bodies. Now, this is a biological pathway that regulates your sleep, mood, and appetite, as well as other processes.
Your body produces a neurotransmitter called anandamide in order to maintain homeostasis, which is the state of steady internal physical and chemical conditions maintained by living systems. It can elevate your mood and reduce anxiety.
This neurotransmitter, anandamide, along with other endocannabinoids, bind to receptors that are called CB1 and CB2.
THC has a similar shape to anandamide, so it fits perfectly in these receptors, which makes it able to stimulate your endocannabinoid system, just like anandamide can.
THC binding to the CB1 receptors causes most people to experience a blissed-out high, though people with a genetic mutation that makes them produce more anandamide actually feel less pleasure with THC than they do without. Now, CBD has the same exact chemical composition as THC, but a tiny difference in how the molecules are arranged creates vastly different effects. CBD doesn't fit into the CB1 receptors like THC does, so it won't get you high.
However, it can actually turn the receptors off using a mechanism called allosteric inhibition. This explains why a cannabis strain with a lot of CBD in it might make you feel less high, but it has other effects beyond that.
Type 1 diabetes is a chronic condition in which there is destruction of the beta cells in the pancreas, and it's these cells that produce insulin, which is the hormone that regulates a person's blood sugar level. Without insulin, blood sugar production is, let's just say, out of control. Think of insulin as the train operator who opens the doors of the train. In this case, the blood that transports the glucose to various cells around the body that need the glucose or sugar as their energy source.
Without the insulin, the sugar can't exit the blood vessels and get into those cells. Just like a freight train where the doors won't open to let out the passengers of the freight. The freight and passengers pile up in the train as the sugar would pile up in the blood vessel.
That is why we find such high levels of glucose in the blood vessels of the body in untreated or poorly treated diabetics. With very little time left in our show, I'm going to start with the conclusion of the next topic on diabetes and then leave by telling you what is possibly in store as related to treatment and cure.
In a nutshell, there are many challenges that must be addressed before stem cells can be used to regenerate eyelid tissue in persons with diabetes.
First, researchers have to identify the pancreatic stem cells because at present it appears to be difficult to ascertain which cell types have the greatest potential for diabetic therapy. Not only that, modulating the autoimmune responses in type 1 diabetes remains a significant challenge regardless of the type of cell that is transplanted. It will also be important to address something called insulin resistance in type 2 diabetes, as well as factors that contribute to obesity.
However, because diabetes is a disease with a major deficiency in the functioning of one type of cell, there is potential of stem cells to treat type 1 diabetes and to improve the quality of life for those with type 2 diabetes.
As researchers learn more about the mechanisms that govern stem cell programming, differentiation, and renewal, their ability to identify, isolate, and culture candidate stem cells will continue to improve. Many transplants have been reported using various protocols, including the Edmonton Protocol, which involves isolating islets from the cadaver pancreatic tissue of multiple donors and infusing them into the recipient's portal vein. We'll see more and more of this in the coming decade.
Here, the problem is lack of available appropriate donor tissue and the strenuous regimen of immunosuppressive drugs necessary to keep the body from rejecting the transplant tissue.
Moreover, the isolation process for islet damages the transplantable tissue, so 2 to 3 donors are required to obtain the minimal cell mass that's sufficient for transplantation into a single recipient. In theory, stem cells that can differentiate into B cells in response to molecular signals in the local pancreatic environment could be introduced into the body, where they would then migrate to the damaged tissue and differentiate as necessary to maintain the appropriate B-cell mass. That is in theory. Once isolated from other cells, these differentiated cells could be transplanted into the patient.
As such, stem cell therapy would directly benefit persons with type 1 diabetes by replenishing B-cells that are destroyed by autoimmune processes.
Unfortunately, it would still be necessary to mitigate the autoimmune destruction of the B cells. Within the pancreas are thousands of islet of Langerhans cells that produce and secrete hormone.
The insulin-producing B cell is one type of endocrine cell in the islet, although there are other types such as alpha cells, A cells, which produce glucagon, gamma cells, which produce pancreatic polypeptide, and delta cells that produce somatostatin.
Each of these cell types arises from a precursor cell type during the process of development. Therefore, the key step for using stem cells to treat diabetes is to identify the precursor cells that ultimately give rise to the B cell. Now, this is not an easy process, at least at this time.
Because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, controlling the autoimmune response is critical to the success of any potential stem cell-based therapy.
Maybe a break is imminent, and we will see this change in our lifetimes.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.